ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Aklına herhangi bir şey gelen bakıyorsunuz.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A number of ambassadors and military attachés of different countries in Taiwan have signed a memorial book to commemorate the high status of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top Iranian scientist who was assassinated on November 27th. The diplomats have voiced their hatred and condemnation against this act of terror.
Right after the assassination, Russia has strongly condemned the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and believes that the main goal of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absert, east of the capital Taiwan. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote a once peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear program.
The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani. or the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is still low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting and help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering. Faisal al-Mikdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, 2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
On the issue of Palestine, a few weak and humiliated governments defied the world of Islam and the Islamic Ummah by ignoring the Palestinian cause and by establishing relations with the usurper and murderer. Undoubtedly, all these maladies will be cured with the unity of the Islamic Ummah, and the problems that Islamic governments and nations are suffering from, wherever you look, there are many problems from Kashmir to Libya, will be eliminated thanks to the Muslims' unity. These statements were about Unity Week.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
As for the issue of the 13th of Aban, it is interesting that this year's 13th of Aban, the day of fighting against arrogance, has coincided with the birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet. This reminds us of the holy ayah, Muhammad is the apostle of Allah, and those who are with him are strong against kuffar, compassionate amongst each other. The Holy Quran, chapter 48, verse 29. On the one hand, there is a birthday, and on the other hand, there is this strong against kuffar. The movement that our youth launched was a great movement. The 13th of Aban is the manifestation of the Iranian nation's fight against arrogance. It was not the case that they had problems with a few people residing in an embassy. Rather, the issue was an important symbolic endeavor in fighting against arrogance, a move that was duly carried out. Well, the American regime is an arrogant regime, and an arrogant regime is a collection of many detriments, mischiefs, and evil things. An arrogant regime is warmongering, terrorist, and also a cultivator of terrorists. It is interfering, corrupt, and monopolistic. When we speak of an arrogant regime, arrogance contains all these ugly notions, evil things, and mischiefs. Therefore, fighting against such arrogance and such a phenomenon is synonymous with reality. Therefore, fighting against such arrogance and such a phenomenon is synonymous with rationality. Some people claim that this was against reason and acumen, but it was not against reason. Rather, it was the manifestation of rationality. It would be irrational to surrender and to give in to that regime.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises. To Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
Morocco and Israel have reached a U.S. brokered agreement on normalizing relations. Under the deal, Rabat will establish full diplomatic relations and resume official contacts with Tel Aviv. As part of the agreement, Donald Trump, who is due to leave office on January the 20th, agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the contested Western Sahara region. Reacting to the new development, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas issued a statement strongly condemning the Tel Aviv-Rabat agreement as a political sin. Also, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement condemned normalization deal, describing it as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. Morocco is now the fourth Arab country after the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan to agree to a normalization deal with the Israelis since August. To help us better understand how Palestinians feel about this deal, we're now joined by our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, who's with us from Gaza. Ashraf.
Yes, but the Palestinians are outraged by this new normalization agreement between the Israeli regime and Morocco. This follows normalization of ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and the Israeli regime. Hamas movement said the normalization, this normalization agreement is basically a political sin and only encourages the Israeli regime to violate the rights of Palestinians. Islamic Jihad movement described this agreement as treason and betrayal to Jerusalem al-Quds and the Palestinian cause, while Mujahideen movement said that such agreement will never give the Israeli regime legitimacy or security. And also on Friday night, the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza said that the normalization of ties between Morocco and the Israeli regime is a backstab and will never hide the, quote, the ugly face of the Israeli regime. Palestinians feel betrayed by the normalization of ties between Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region and the Israeli regime. And now you have United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, and already Egypt and Jordan have had so-called peace deals with the Israeli regime before.
All right, thanks a lot, Ashraf. That was our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, joining us from Gaza. Also with us on tonight's debate, we have journalist and political analyst Mr. Elijah Magnier joining us from Caracas. Also, we have CEO of the Ramadan Foundation, Mr. Mohammed Shafiq, who's joining us from Manchester. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Caracas. Sir, how do you view this deal, taking into account the timing of it, as Donald Trump is on his way out?
I think Donald Trump is trying not to leave to Joe Biden the possibility to collect the work of normalization between Israel and other Muslim countries. And it makes no sense, it is not in the interest of the U.S. to see normalization between Morocco and Israel in particular, because the Moroccan population are really not in favor of the Israelis. I've been to Morocco several times, and I see how people behave with the Israeli, what they think, and what is their real feeling toward the Palestinian cause. This is one of the rare times the king of Morocco accepts to make a step that is completely against the will of the population, and this is why it is indeed a political normalization. Israel is going to gain a few flights between Morocco and Israel, and the publicity for Netanyahu is really in need to boost his image because he's in deep trouble domestically by facing a new elections. He has the manifestation daily under his house. He's struggling because Israel is facing the biggest economic crisis ever. And also it is the normalization with these countries who never pose a threat to Israel is also commented by the Israeli media itself, saying it doesn't make a lot of sense really because these were not the enemy of Israel. So it's a kind of a show. However, this is different from the Emirati normalization because the Emirati population find themselves quickly integrated with the Israelis. This is not going to happen with Morocco.
Mohamed Shafir, I'd like to get your thoughts on the agreement as well. As part of it, Donald Trump, who's due to leave office, as we mentioned earlier on January the 20th, agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over the contested Western Sahara region. How will this deal affect Western Sahara? We also know it's not legal nor internationally binding for the U.S. to make this kind of deal concerning an area that's halfway across the world.
Yeah, I think it's a really sad moment that you've got Arab countries that have made relationships with Israel even before a Palestinian state has been recognized and enshrined under international law. And for that to happen, there's got to be an end to the occupation by the Israelis of West Bank, of Gaza, of the Golan Heights, and, you know, illegal settlements that have been built successively over decades, increasing the presence of Israeli citizens in Palestinian territories. And I think it's a really sad moment that the Arab world, instead of continuing to stand in unity with the Palestinian people and their struggle for freedom, is letting their relationship with a right-wing xenophobe in the White House, in this term, Donald Trump, on his way out after a humiliating defeat in the presidential election, and trying to restore relationships between the Israelis and Arab countries. And I think what we have to now do is that civic society, as my colleague from Caracas has said, is that civic society, the ordinary man and woman on the streets in Arab countries and around the world, are standing with Palestine in solidarity against the occupation, against the daily bombardment we see from the Israelis in the West Bank and in Gaza, where I've been three times and seen for myself the carnage that people live under. So, you know, we may be downbeaten, we may be concerned, and we may be, you know, disillusioned. But I think it requires us to refocus our energy and commitment to the Palestinian cause, because it's a cause worthwhile supporting. The world, as Nelson Mandela said, the world is not truly free until the Palestinians are free.
Elijah Magnier, Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement has condemned the agreement, describing it as a betrayal of Jerusalem al-Quds. In the past, the Islamic Jihad movement warned that recognizing the Israeli regime is a great threat for the region. Do you see it in that light as well?
I think Israel is a threat to the region. Like the Russian ambassador said yesterday, one of the Russian ambassadors, Israel is carrying out unlawful assassination, is aggressive towards its neighbors, has carried out hundreds of attacks against Syria, is preventing the right of return of the owner of the land in Palestine, is attacking Lebanon, has attacked Iraq, is attacking even in Yemen. So Israel is taking the initiative on what is called a prevention attack under this false and unlawful title, attacking other neighbor countries because of domestic issues or because of its own policy. And also it is showing that it is not worth of making peace with any country around the Middle East. And what we see, unfortunately, is the Arab states have given up on the Palestinian cause, at the exception of Iran, that is still holding it and holding tight to it. Of course, there is Kuwait that has not normalized yet, but it doesn't have a power to stand against the Americans and the Israelis, while Iran has. So the Palestinian cause at the end of the day, it's a universal cause of the right of the people to survive and to have their independence and have back their land, regardless the sectarian, regardless the religion, regardless the geography. And this is unfortunately not happening because there is no more international law. That's finished. We see when the Americans are imposing sanctions to starved population, it is a clear violation of the international law, and they don't care about it. So at the United Nations, there is a saying law for all in equal. Well, they should change that and saying no law for everybody. There's no more law. That's why the normalization with the Israelis on behalf of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian will, who refuse such a normalization until they get back their territory, is a crime not only against the Palestinians, because it is not right to say the Palestinian cause belongs to the Palestinians, but because to the free world, it belongs to the free world. And that is a crime against the free world.
Mohammed Shafi, four Arab governments have now established ties with the Israelis. In your opinion, does this put the security of the region at risk?
Yeah, I think it does, to the extent that, as you see, the biggest obstacle to peace in the Middle East is resolving the conflict of Palestine. And I think that, if that can be resolved, if Israel can stop its illegal settlements, stop its daily oppression of the Palestinian people, stop the siege in Gaza, as we've seen for so many years, then there is a chance for peace and there's a chance for normalization. But what you cannot do is start the process of normalization and claim that you then still support a two-state solution, as some of these Arab countries do. They're entitled to their own foreign policies. They're entitled to have their own relationships. But what they're not entitled to is trying to, show the world that somehow they're supporters of Palestine, and at this step, establishing relationships with the Israeli authorities is somehow supported by the masses of the people. It's not. And I think it's really imperative that we all raise our voices in solidarity with the Palestinian people and be very clear about that. You talked about, my colleague in Caracas talked about just Iran, being the obstacle to Israel and its wider agenda. Actually, I'll add a few countries to that. You look at Malaysia, you look at Pakistan, the Prime Minister Imran Khan has been very clear that he would never recognize Israel until there was a Palestinian state. So there are many players, including the Turks, who have been very forthright. Whilst they have diplomatic relations with the Israeli country, but they have a love-hate relationship, if you like, and President Erdogan is quite outspoken on those issues. But I think you're seeing that leadership now from beyond the Arab states, because Palestine is not dependent on the Arab states. Palestine is dependent on the voice across the world, and that's been articulated by Prime Minister of Pakistan so eloquently in the last few weeks in his comments on never recognizing Israel until there is a free Palestinian state.
Mr. Magnier, the resistance movement Hamas has said that the deal will increase Israel's belligerence and its denial of the rights of the Palestinian people. Are these normalization deals, in a way, giving a green light for the Israelis to continue their brutal day-to-day violation of the rights of the Palestinians?
With or without normalization, the Israelis continue their aggressive behavior toward their neighbors and other Middle Eastern states. They consider they pose a danger to Israel expansion and plans. Just let me add something here, that no U.S. president ever managed to stop the Israeli settlements. Only Iran is supporting the Palestinian cause by financial means, media, and transfer of experience. The other state my colleague has mentioned, which I really appreciate, they vocally support Palestinians, but the Palestinians, although the vocal support is very appreciated, but the Palestinians need more than that. They are starving, they are surrounded, and Qatar from time to time give them money only for them not to rebel against the Israelis. So yes, Israel will continue his aggression. Israel, only by a policy of deterrence like Hezbollah has imposed on Lebanon, that Israel will stop being aggressive against countries who rejected the U.S. hegemony and the Israeli ipso facto in the region, and that is Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and Iran. And these are the countries on the front line against Israel expansion and to stop its belligerent act in the Middle East.
Sure. Mohammad Shafiq, in the wake of these normalization deals, all Palestinian factions have been adamant that they will continue on with their resistance. How do you see the aftermath of this deal? Will we see a more united Palestinian front in the face of these measures?
I think one of the consequences of why this is happening is because of that broken disunity under Mahmoud Abbas and the PLO, who continued to negotiate and work with the Israeli government whilst not receiving anything in return. So we see a massive increase in the number of illegal settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. We see the continued oppression of the Palestinian people. We see what, the situation in Gaza and how important it is, as I said, raising one's voice, contributing to helping the humanitarian care issues, but also being very clear that our support is dependent on the Palestinians unifying. And I think if there's anything coming out of this, I think it shows the Palestinian leadership from Fatah, from Islamic Jihad, from all the various political organizations that they have to unite under the umbrella of the Palestinian struggle to make sure that there is freedom for the Palestinian people. And because this is a just cause that requires leadership and support from around the world. And that's what people like myself, I'm a British Pakistani Muslim, very proud of my heritage, very proud that my Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has taken such a vocal step in speaking up in favor of the Palestinians and never recognizing Israel until the Palestinians have a state. But I'm also equally proud of the fact that I've been somebody who's been to Gaza in the last, I went in 2013-14, I went three times. So I've seen what life is like for the Palestinians, and their struggle is my struggle, and I'll continue to raise my voice wherever I can on any platform to support the struggle for the Palestinian cause.
Elijah Magnier, what about the insufficient international response? Like the OIC, like the Arab League, as we know, failed to condemn the recent normalization deals. Do you think Arab governments are now turning a blind eye to the suffering of their Palestinian brethren?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the Arabs are turning a blind eye on the suffering of the Palestinians. I think the Arabs are partners of the suffering of the Palestinians. By accepting to normalize with Israel, there is no more Arab League. There is no more any unification among Arab countries for one cause, the essential cause of Palestine. We saw how the Saudis and the Qatari relationship went to the floor. We saw how the Saudis behaved with other countries in the Middle East. And we saw the aggressive from Saudi Arabia toward Lebanon and Syria for 9 years of war. Qatar also participated in that. These are members of the Arab League. Yes, what my colleague said, I fully agree with. The disunity among the Palestinians is the problem. By a unified front among the Palestinians, then the Arabs will have to move, but they're not, because Mahmoud Abbas is always on the camp of the Americans, and recently in the last couple of weeks, he changed his mind without even informing the Palestinians that he is going back to his old relationship and coordination on the security and all other level with the Israelis and the Americans. The Arab League doesn't exist anymore. There is no more Arab League since the war in Iraq, since the war in Syria, since the violation of the territory of the Palestinian and the normalization of all the country encouraged by Saudi Arabia. Morocco would never have gone to normalize with the Israelis without the pressure of Mohammed bin Salman. So the Emirati is the same, the Bahraini is the same, the Omani is the same, they all followed. Sudan is exactly the same. So no, there's no more Arab League, and there is no more Palestinian cause for this bunch of countries.
Mohammad Shafiq, do you agree with our other guest? He says that Arab governments are not only complacent now, but are complicit in the suffering of the Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, you can take Egypt, for example, that has the Rafah crossing. It's continued to close the crossing. Very little humanitarian aid is being let through those crossings. And so it's a contributing factor into the ongoing struggle for a Palestinian freedom. And I think my colleague is absolutely right that the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Conference have become toothless. We have a maniac in the White House in his final few days trying to force, nudge, threaten other countries to recognize Israel. And America, you know, having so-called independent foreign policy, is now in a position where it's doing the bidding for its ally Israel in the region. And that's a real concern, that if you continue to, as I said, occupy Palestinian lands, you have illegal settlements, you have Gaza under an open-air prison, and the world recognizes the injustice, but the people with the power to change it are refusing to do that. And so I think, yeah, it's absolutely right that you look at, you know, look at the Kashmiri cause from my neck of the woods in Pakistan, and Kashmiri, a struggle very much similar to what is happening to the Palestinians, very much similar. The OIC refused to acknowledge it. The OIC refused to discuss it. And I think this is the moment for the masses around the world that believe in individual freedom,
sure,
and from our Islamic faith, to stand up against injustice anywhere in the world. And that should be our mission. And that's why we should support the cause of Palestine.
Okay, Elijah Magnier, one last question for you, very briefly, if you may. About these normalization deals, Donald Trump said more countries will be joining in. He mentioned, quote-unquote, some of the big ones. Who are you expecting to see now before Trump leaves office?
I think he probably is thinking about Indonesia. He's probably thinking about Saudi Arabia, that is waiting for more countries to join in, and he would very much like to impose on Saudi Arabia, because he has a very strong card to wave in front of Mohammed bin Salman, that is the assassination of Khashoggi. And this is why he's holding him by the neck,
right,
and will force the Saudi recognition of Israel before the end of his term in office in 20 January 2021.
All right, thanks to my guest, journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Caracas. Also thanks to CEO of the Ramadan Foundation, Mohammad Shafiq, joining us from the British capital, London. And also special thanks to you for staying with us on Debate. Goodbye until next time.
www.parstoday.com/en. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
By the end of the year, an estimated 50 million Americans will experience food insecurity, according to Feeding America, a national anti-hunger organization. That's about 1 in 6 people. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "The Senate's Latest COVID Stimulus Won't Solve the Hunger and Housing Crisis Across the U.S." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. After months of fruitless negotiations, the latest COVID relief package is emerging from U.S. Congress as a stopgap measure meant to hold the nation over until Joe Biden takes office and Congress begins a new session next year. For the time being, hopes are pinned on a $908 billion proposal drawn up by a bipartisan group of moderate lawmakers that includes only a fraction of the funding that advocates say is necessary to contain a widespread hunger and housing crisis in the middle of a pandemic that has claimed more than 280,000 lives in the U.S. About 83 million adults, about 34% of the country, are already struggling to afford basic necessities such as food and rent as job growth slows and dozens of pandemic relief provisions are set to expire before the end of the month, including emergency unemployment insurance and paid sick leave. If Congress does not act, 12 million people could have their unemployment payments cut off the day after Christmas. Analysts say nearly 12 million people are thousands of dollars behind on rent. Between 30 million and 40 million renters are at risk of losing their homes when a moratorium on eviction set by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, expires at the end of the year, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. While the moratorium has helped keep people in their homes, housing activists say it contains loopholes exploited by landlords. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has pushed for an even slimmer $500 billion package and had not signaled support for the compromise bill by Tuesday morning, December 8, raising fears that no relief may be coming at all, according to Bloomberg. Congress must also vote to fund the government before year-end deadlines, and lawmakers are moving to pass a one-week funding bill to buy more time for budget and coronavirus negotiations that are coming down to the wire. By the end of the year, an estimated 50 million Americans will experience food insecurity, according to Feeding America National Anti-Hunger Organization. That's about one in six people. Across the U.S., lines of cars waiting for food donations and stretching for miles have underscored the severity of the unfolding crisis. The $908 billion package is less than half the cost of the $2.2 trillion CARES Act passed in March that provided stimulus checks starting at $1,200 to most taxpayers. House Democrats passed another $2.2 trillion package in October after passing a $3 trillion package in May, but both went nowhere in the Republican-controlled Senate. The latest bipartisan deal does not include another round of $1,200 stimulus checks, as many had hoped. The first round of checks, approved by Congress in spring, temporarily kept millions of people out of poverty, but the pandemic has dragged on since. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and other leading Democrats have thrown their support behind the compromise package and promised to pass more comprehensive legislation next year. Some Republicans are also reportedly co-seeding around the proposal. This is long overdue and is not enough, said Sarah Sadian, the Vice President of Public Policy at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, in an interview. The compromise package is a stopgap relief bill, not a stimulus, and progressives say Congress must provide direct cash payments to stimulate the economy and protect struggling households from financial ruin. Recently, Senator Bernie Sanders said the package must be improved to gain his support. Sanders said the proposal does not come close to providing enough financial relief for struggling households and contains liability protections for corporations and other employers whose workers are sickened by COVID-19 on the job. Critics say the liability protections would provide legal cover for nursing homes and meat packing plants where COVID has quickly spread and killed workers, But the protections are a top priority for Republicans who are eager to keep people on the job, despite a terrifying surge of infections nationwide. Tens of millions of Americans living in desperation today would receive absolutely no financial help from this proposal. Sanders said in a statement recently, "That is not acceptable," he added. Currently, 12% of adults report that their households do not have enough to eat, and 40% of children live in the households that either cannot afford enough food or are behind on rent. According to analysis of census data by the Centers on Budget and Policy Priorities, rates of financial hardship are higher among households of color, and 49% of black households reported that it was somewhat or very difficult to pay for household expenses in recent weeks. That's nearly twice the rate of white households and a reflection of long-standing inequities in employment, education, and housing. The $908 billion compromise does contain several of relief priorities for which Democrats have been pushing. The legislation would temporarily extend emergency unemployment benefits until March, with a $300 weekly bonus preventing millions of households from falling off a fiscal cliff. The package also contains $160 billion in badly needed funding for state, local, and tribal governments, which have struggled to maintain services and tax revenue through the pandemic. Cities and states are going to use these funds to keep people in their homes, and that's a really important critical resource. But Congress and the Biden administration need to make it a top priority to come back after the new year and work on a real comprehensive bill. Saadian added, "This can't be the end-all be-all of COVID relief. It's just not enough." The compromise package contains $25 billion for housing assistance for renters, but the National Low-Income Housing Coalition says at least $100 billion is ultimately needed to combat a housing crisis that is only growing during the pandemic. Nearly 19 million low-income renter households were already cost-burdened before the pandemic hit, and now millions of people have lost jobs and other forms of income. Kamo Walton, an organizer with Right to the City Alliance, a national coalition of grassroots housing justice groups, said Democrats must also push for a much stronger eviction moratorium than the currently put in place by the CDC. Housing justice activists across the U.S. have been busy fighting evictions despite the moratorium, and evictions have already led to hundreds of thousands of additional COVID-19 cases, according to recently published research. Some people don't want to deal with facing a sheriff if they're physically evicted, so they're being harassed by landlords and decide that the better option for them is just to leave, Walton said in an interview. Walton said a broad coalition of housing justice groups is demanding that Democrats push for a blanket eviction moratorium that prevents all evictions until after the pandemic is over, along with a national moratorium on utility shutoffs. Under the current moratorium, Walton said, renters must preemptively file paperwork to stop an eviction. Congress should change that to put the burden of proof on landlords, Walton said. Walton said renters also need help paying rent and utility bills. If the stopgap relief package passes with only $25 billion in renter assistance, Saadian said, funding should be targeted toward the lowest income renters who are at greatest risk of becoming homeless.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.